Before Europeans could discover new lands, they had to explore the oceans. To reach Asia, seafarers needed not just the maneuverable vessels and navigational aids increasingly used in the 14th century, but also knowledge of the sea, its currents, and especially its winds. Wind would power their ships. But how did the winds run? Where would Atlantic breezes carry their square-rigged ships, which, even with the addition of a triangular sail, needed to run before the wind, that is, to have the wind directly behind the vessel? Europeans first learned to navigate the oceans in the region that has been called the Mediterranean Atlantic, which lies south and west of Spain and includes three groups of islands, the Azores, the Canaries, and the Madeiras. Europeans reached all three sets of islands during the 14th century. The Canaries proved a popular destination for mariners from the Iberian Peninsula. Sailing to the Canaries from Europe was easy, because strong winds known as the Northeast Trades blow southward along the coastline. The voyage took about a week, and the volcanic peaks on the islands made them difficult to miss, even with imprecise navigational instruments. The problem was getting back. The Iberian sailor attempting to return home faced a major obstacle. The very winds that had brought him so quickly to the Canaries now blew directly at him. Early travelers to the islands sometimes used galleys powered by oarsmen as well as by sails. But even oarsmen had a difficult time fighting the contrary winds and currents. Another alternative was similarly tedious, tacking back and forth to the east and west, attempting each time to make more headway north. What could be done? Some unknown seafarer figured out the answer: sailing around the wind. If a mariner could not sail against the trade winds, he had to sail as close as possible to the direction from which the wind was coming without being forced to tack. In the Mediterranean Atlantic, that meant pointing his vessel northwest into the open ocean, away from land, until weeks later he reached the winds that would carry him home, the so-called westerlies. Those winds blow, we now know, though the mariners at first did not, northward along the coast of North America before heading east toward Europe. This solution must at first have seemed to defy common sense, but it became the key to successful exploration of both the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. The strategy might seem to take a sailor hundreds of miles out of the way, but in the long run, it was safer and surer than attempting the monumental task of tacking against the wind. A mariner familiar with the technique could sail into unknown waters, confident that he could find his way back home again. During the 15th century, armed with knowledge of the winds and currents of the Mediterranean Atlantic, Iberian seamen regularly visited the three island groups, all of which they could reach in 2 weeks or less. The Azores and Madeiras had no native inhabitants, so they were soon settled by Europeans who raised livestock, planted food crops, and began to import Jewish and Muslim slaves from Iberia to raise sugarcane for export to the mainland. After Europeans conquered and displaced the Guanche people who lived on the Canaries, they also raised sugarcane there. Collectively, the Canaries and Madeira became known as the Wine Islands because much of their sugar production was employed to make sweet wines. Even before Christopher Columbus set sail to the west, Europeans learned key lessons of colonization in the Mediterranean Atlantic: how to transplant their crops and livestock to exotic locations, how to conquer native peoples, and how to establish plantations to grow lucrative crops for export. Christopher Columbus knew the Mediterranean Atlantic well. Born in 1451 in the Italian city-state of Genoa, Columbus, who was the largely self-educated son of a wool merchant, was by the 1490s an experienced sailor and map-maker. Like many mariners of the day, he sailed frequently in and around the Canaries and Madeiras. Like all accomplished seafarers, Columbus knew the world was round. So, for that matter, did most educated people. The idea that his contemporaries believed the world to be flat is a myth dating from the 19th century. But Columbus differed from other cartographers in his estimate of the world's size. He thought that China lay only 3,000 miles from the southern European coast. Thus, he argued, it would be easier to reach Asia by sailing west than by making a difficult voyage around the southern tip of Africa. Experts scoffed at this crackpot notion, accurately predicting that the two continents lay 12,000 miles apart. When Columbus in 1484 asked the Portuguese authorities to back his plan to sail west to Asia, they rejected his crazy scheme. Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, ruling a newly united kingdom and jealous of Portugal's recent successes developing trade with Africa, were more receptive to Columbus's ideas. The monarchs agreed to finance the risky voyage, in part because they hoped the profits would pay for an expedition to conquer Muslim-held Jerusalem. And so, on August 3, 1492, Columbus set sail from the Spanish port of Palos with three ships, the Pinta, the Niña, and the Santa Maria. The ships first steered down the northeast trades to the Canary Islands. There Columbus refitted his square-rigged ships, adding triangular sails to make them more maneuverable. On September 6th, the ships weighed anchor and headed out into the Atlantic. Just over a month later, pushed by favorable trade winds, the vessels found land approximately where Columbus had predicted. On October 12th, he and his men landed on an island in the Bahamas, which its inhabitants called Guanahani, but which he renamed San Salvador. Because Columbus's description of his landfall can be interpreted in different ways, its location is still disputed. Later, Columbus went on to explore the islands now known as Cuba and Hispaniola, which their residents, the Taino people, called Colba and Bohio. Because he thought he had reached the Indies, Columbus referred to the inhabitants of the region as Indians. Three themes predominate in Columbus's log, the major source of information on this first encounter. First, he insistently asked the Tainos where he could find gold, pearls, and valuable spices. Each time, his informants replied that such products could be obtained on other islands, on the mainland, or in cities in the interior. Eventually, he came to mistrust their answers, noting, "I am beginning to believe they will tell me anything I want to hear." Second, Columbus wrote repeatedly of the strange and beautiful plants and animals. "Here the fishes are so unlike ours that it is amazing," he said. "The colors are so bright that anyone would marvel." And he added, "The song of the little birds might make a man wish never to leave here. I never tire from looking at such luxurious vegetation." Yet Columbus's interest was not only aesthetic. He observed that, "I believe that there are many plants and trees here that could be worth a lot in Spain for use as dyes, spices, and medicines," adding that he was carrying home to Europe a sample of everything I can, so that he could have experts examine them. Third, Columbus also described the island's human inhabitants, and he seized some to take back to Spain. The Tainos were, he said, very handsome, gentle, and friendly, though they told him of fierce people who raided their villages and lived on other nearby islands. The Caniba, today called Caribs, from whose name the word cannibal is derived, were reported to eat their captives, but historians today disagree about whether those tales were true. Columbus believed the Tainos to be likely converts to Catholicism, but he had more in mind than conversion. "The islanders ought to make good and skilled servants," Columbus declared. "It would be easy to," he said, subject everyone and make them do what you wished." Columbus made three more voyages to the west, exploring most of the major Caribbean islands and sailing along the coasts of Central and South America. Until the day he died in 1506 at the age of 55, Columbus believed that he had reached Asia. Even before his death, others knew better. Because the Florentine Amerigo Vespucci, who explored the South American coast in 1499, was the first to publish the idea that a new continent had been discovered, the cartographer Martin Waldseemüller labeled the land America, as can be seen in his famous 1507 map. Before going on to learn about the land Columbus found, you might want to look at the websites listed here, which focus on him, his exploratory voyages, maps, and other journeys of discovery.